Hi, grifters. Welcome to a very special edition of the Leverage 10 podcast. As always, I'm your host, Kayla Dobson, and today we have something a little different in store for you. On Saturday, June 9th, Electric Entertainment and TNT hosted a special screening of Leverage Episode 405, The Van Gogh Job, for the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences at the Leonard H. Goldenson Theater in North Hollywood. The screening was followed by a Q&A session hosted by yours truly and featured a star-studded panel. We were able to record that panel and are now bringing it to you as a podcast. We hope you enjoy the first half of this very special two-parter and tune in next time to hear the rest. Wasn't that wonderful? So the writer of this episode, co-creator and executive producer of Leverage, Chris Downey. The director of this episode and also the co-creator and executive producer, John Rogers. He's given us feature films such as Independence Day, Stargate, The Patriot. He's made documentaries, TV movies, TV shows. A true Renaissance man and executive producer of Leverage, Dean Devlin.
Renaissance man?
Renaissance man.
Pretty sure the Renaissance man was late checking the score on the Celtics game.
And tonight we have a very special guest. Please give a big round of applause to the man behind it all, the brains behind our Leverage team, our very own Nate Ford, Academy Award winner Timothy Hutton. Well, welcome everyone, and thank you so much for being here, especially Tim, who flew in today. As I understand, you're shooting the middle of the fifth season of Leverage up in Portland.
Absolutely. Very good to be here.
So let's jump right into talking about this episode that we just saw, The Van Gogh Job. Chris is the writer of this episode. Can you tell us a little bit about the genesis behind the idea? I mean, how did you come up with that?
Episodes come from a lot of different sources. I get inspired a lot by locations, and we took a trip up to Portland, which, if our wives are listening to this online, it was not a boondoggle at all. It was very productive. We went up to just before the season to take a look at some places we hadn't shot before, and one of the places we went to was Oaks Park, which was this roller rink in this episode. And I remember walking around with John and Dean, and the first thing that struck me was that you didn't have to dress this place to make it look like it was from the 1940s. It was from the 1940s. They haven't really updated at all. And I got struck by just, they had a kind of historical section where they had just pictures from back in the 40s when, I guess, roller skating was a big deal. All over the country, there were traveling roller skating troupes. And I took John aside when we got out of the touring this place, and I said, we got to do a period piece here. And we had been wanting to do something, a flashback episode, for a long time. So the first thing was, let's find a story that takes place here in Oaks Park. And then, we want to try and weave in elements of Leverage, so, you know, the idea of art that was looted from the battlefield in World War II was something we had wanted a subject we'd wanted to deal with. Felt like a good marriage. And, our two characters in the show, Parker and Hardison, we were planning to bring them together as a couple this season. And here was a kind of an opportunity. You know, it's an interesting thing when you have two couples. You have an interracial couple in 2012. There's no issue. And when you're able to kind of put them back into the 1940s, it creates drama. And we wanted to kind of put them let's try and see what this couple would have been like back then.
I'll actually say it was nice because Chris did an enormous amount of research. He got contacted a professor of African American Studies at the University of Portland. And originally, one of our worries was, well, we want to dramatize it, but it wasn't the South. And then when we did the research, the professor was like, it was plenty horrible. And so we were able to not change this original idea of the story at all. So we tried to be as historically accurate as we could, both because it gives you a better show, and out of respect. I mean, you're playing with some fairly serious issues, so you don't want to treat them lightly.
So for the rest of you, John, Dean, Tim, what was your first reaction when you heard the pitch? It's a little bit of a change of pace for Leverage, so what did you think?
We can't afford a show that takes place in World War II. Are you
kidding? It is the one time I've raised my voice with Chris Downey in 5 years of television. He turned in the draft, and the next day he walked in the room, and yeah, I'm also the executive producer with him, and I literally said, exterior Nazi-occupied France?
All right, how about exterior French countryside?
With Nazis. Yeah. It's the same thing. Yeah.
And for the cast, we just thought, this is fun, let's go.
Show up, wear clothing, do accents. It's great. You guys have a great time. But I tell you, this was a testimony to the fact that the company that Dean has built, because you know, it's an independently produced cable show. A lot of people don't know that. There's no studio. It's him. And you know, if we can, yeah. You know, ten years ago there were 42 independent television studios. Now there's one, and it's that guy. And you know, the great thing about it is, if we have a project we care passionately about, we can go to him and we can make the argument. He's like, if we can figure out a way to work, if there's a way we can pay for it, go for it and figure it out. And so we went up and scouted it. And Oak Park is that skating rink is right on the edge of Oak Park. And he said, well, if we can put two episodes back to back, we can afford it. And so the writing staff then wrote another episode, which happened at an amusement park, right behind the skating rink. So we knew we had that money. And then we went out and scouted. And the field, that bridge, was literally across the road from the skating rink. So we had the train trestle there. And then right through there is the lake where we actually shot, you can see the lake in the background, the battle scene. And behind that was where we put the countryside. The entire episode was shot within a 75-yard radius of each other. And that's, but, you know, and we got very lucky. But it was, Dean kept going, if you can make it work, I will support you 100%. And, you know, the crew really pulled together and managed to put a lot of production value up on the state, on the screen for us.
So, John, you directed this episode. And, you know, can you talk a little bit more about that experience? We already know that there were some challenges with exterior Nazi-occupied France.
Right.
And you also have to wear multiple hats while directing. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, it was good that it was Chris's script, so it was two executive producers. Mm-hmm. And as a result, there was a lot of, you know, where some writers might fight, we could look at each other and go, okay, no, we both know as EPs we can't do this or we can't do that. It's kind of right. This was the second episode of television I ever directed. And as a result, I was utterly terrified. And you know, everything I learned about directing, I learned basically from Dean, from watching Dean direct on the show and everything like that. So it really was the crew. I knew the story was great. Once we had done the scout, we found the location, we found all the locations around it, and then it was a matter of relying on the really great crew that you put together on a TV show, which unlike movies, when you know, you go in and you have these people one time, and relying on the actors to you know, they dressed on set, they changed their schedule, they were there waiting for us at all times, ready to go. And everyone pulled together for this episode. The costume designer, Nadine Haters, looked at the piece of art that Chris had found, the Lost Van Gogh, which is a real painting, and built the entire color palette of the costumes around that painting. David Connell, our DP, built a beautiful 1940s lighting scheme that I asked him for really, you know, sort of very bright and dark spaces, even besides the colors. And I have to give a special shout out to Gary Camp, who is our A operator, who is a very important person on a lot of shows. That beautiful shot of the pull away of Beth Reese Graff as she's standing on the tracks, I had planned on pushing in and just staying on her, and it's a great performance. And Gary said, no, it's you're losing her. And Gary hopped on the back of a moving train with a red camera on one shoulder and got that shot. And what's amazing is, if you notice, that shot transitions beautifully out of the bed and lands on them. That was shot 4 days earlier. He knew he was going to do that. The A operator planned it, and he just had it in his head, and he gave it to me like on the day. And I think that's the big thing about directing television, is acknowledging, you know, you are not alone. And that's the thing. I was terrified, but I knew I wasn't alone. And of course, Tim has directed. All the actors have done a million shows. I knew I was going to be fine.
Well, and talking now to you, Tim, you played both Nate and the sheriff on the show. What was it like to have to switch back and forth between those two roles?
Well, it was great. When we all read the script, you know, this idea that we would be playing these characters back in time, I think especially for Beth and Aldous, but certainly for Christian Kane and for Gina Bell and myself, you know, you read a script like that and you get to play those parts in the past, it's great. It's just a very rich story, and you read it and you prepare for it, and it's just one of those things, especially with this show, because every script is so different. Mm-hmm. You know, and we all get together and we talk about the new script, and this was one that we read and we said, well, this is going to be really kind of amazing to jump into. So the combination, as John was talking about, of the amazing production team with Nadine Haters and the cinematographer and the production designer, it just all comes together on this show in quite an amazing way. And we only 7 days schedule to pull off something like
7 day prep, 7 day shoot.
And you know, we didn't have, on this particular episode, we didn't have, you know, it was better for the production not to have dressing rooms and all that kind of thing. So we were changing the back of trees, you know, getting into the period stuff and then back into the.
You did love that hat.
yeah, absolutely. But it was a blast. It really was.
Well, actually, that, speaking of which, I left out Randall Groves, who's our production designer. They changed that roller rink from the modern look to the 1940s look over lunch break. They bombed in, they did a dry run, they planned, they did the layouts, and in between the lunch break, they switched from, which actually was a lot of work. Yeah. It turned out we didn't think we would have to dress it, and when we went back, yeah, we had to dress a lot of it. It's just really that one wall and that old booth was perfect, and they did fantastic work.
And wasn't there a situation where weather forced a key scene?
That was the scene where we first meet Tim's character. Originally, when he interrupts the beating of Charlie Lawson, was originally outside in the back, and it was raining because it's Portland, and it does that always. And we were really jammed up, and it was actually you and Dave Connell said, "Well, why don't we just? We're here. We're set up here. Why don't we do it here?" And it was really one of those great times where the director just shut up, because I originally had them pinned in that corner, and you started walking Aldis out. And as soon as you got him out in rehearsal, you saw Dave Connell, the DP, go, "I know what to do." And he laid the camera way back and gave us that big, beautiful wide shot that ends that moment. And most TV shows don't do the wide. And one of the things that Dean beat into me as a young director is TV directors don't do the wide shot. They don't give you geography. And it really was Tim and Dave Connell who gave me that shot. And I just nodded and went, let's go. I'm going to take credit for that much later.
And if I could just add one more person to give a shout out to, Joe LaDuca, our composer, just did an unbelievable job on this one. I mean, he made, we heard the Wurlitzer play, like finally everyone when we were up there said, "Can we actually hear it play?" It doesn't sound like it sounds in this episode. he made it sound like a church organ, and he wrote some amazing cues that were really authentic to the period. He studied soundtracks from movies from the 40s, and I think this is one of the best soundtracks for an episode we've ever
had. And that's one of the things Dean insists on, is we have Joe scoring every episode. We don't just go straight to like just recorded music. We have a guy sit down and score everyone like a movie.
Well, specifically in this episode, the flashbacks just look stunning. And as we've talked about, the show is shot in Portland, Oregon, and that I'm sure, you know, there's some production challenges. Dean, can you talk a little bit about the challenges that arise when you have to disguise Portland, Oregon as so many different places, you know, exterior Nazi-occupied France and all the different places that the Leverage team goes?
Well, we gave up. So this season, it takes place in Portland. You'll see in the season opener, they move. It meant a lot of digital effects. It meant wiping out mountains from the background. It meant adding landmarks.
How many digital effects do we average an episode?
We average between 30 and 70 effect shots a show, but John broke the record this year on the season opener with 170 effect shots in the season opener this year.
It's a very big episode, I'm sorry.
We steal the spruce goose, so it's a heck of a way to open the season.
Yeah.
But that's how, and we're able to do that because our digital effects are done in-house. So we keep a full-time effects crew through the entire production, much in the same way you would keep a wardrobe department or a lighting crew. So we don't farm out to digital effects houses, and by keeping it internal, we're able to afford it. And in fact, what we found on this show is using this system, it's often more cost-effective for us to do it in post digitally than to shoot it live, and that's a real reversal. You know, traditionally doing digital effects is always more expensive than production, but we've been able to take on some things that normally on a cable television show budget and time you wouldn't even attempt. But by having this at our disposal, we're able to do things like turn Portland into any city in the world.
I'd say, actually, because of the machine that Dean built up there, incredibly, with the breakage we got from the network for Mr. Glover's performance guesting, this was only $5,000 over our regular budget. This thing was damn near on pattern. And it's all because of this kind of machine we've built, Post in particular, that integrates Portland in here.
And no catering.
And no catering. We have no catering. Yeah. Tim actually barbecues a lot.
Bag.
We just... It's delicious, Tim. Don't get me wrong.
So like I said, this was really a beautiful episode, and I know it's one of my favorites. I'm sure a lot of people here really enjoyed it. Can we look forward to any more flashback episodes in the upcoming season?
Yes, we can. I guess I got bitten by the bug.
Button that says unproducible on your laptop?
Maybe. We have one coming up this season. It's similar in the setup. Instead of it being from the point of view of Parker, it's from the point of view of Nate. Tim is really literally carries every single scene of this episode. I couldn't be prouder of it. I guess I can tease a little bit. Ronnie Cox, who Tim was
started in Taps,
is the one telling the story. And the story is about the mystery of D.B. Cooper. I don't know if you guys are familiar with D.B. Cooper. Well, we are going to solve the D.B. Cooper mystery on Leverage this season. Nate is, and it's a pretty incredible ride.
Intellectually, that's interesting. What was really interesting was watching them get in a 70s wardrobe. That was the real fun. they were like kids in a candy store. It was ridiculous. And the mutton chops.
Tim, you want to talk a little bit about doing that, just to tease them a little bit? What that was like?
I think you did a great job. Yeah.
I think it's one of my favorite performances of Tim's in the show because the character is so different than Nate. I mean, on a core level, he's the polar opposite of Nate. And to see you bounce back and forth between those, I mean, that was really spectacular.
Well, it was. It was a great script to read. To look at that and on that note, I mean, Nate being a guy who kind of doesn't find the best in people, thinks the worst of them, and then to play this guy back in time, it was really the mustache that did the best.
Mustache did a lot of acting on it.
Yeah. No, but to suddenly be playing and go back and forth, because it influenced the present day character, and then the present day character had influence on when he goes to talk to Ronnie Cox's character. Nothing what I'm saying right now makes sense because you haven't seen the show, but.
Now there's a lot of makeup change there between the mustache and the sound. Was that difficult to have to go through that on set and the changes and...
Yeah, we just, you know, the great makeup department and wardrobe department, and we worked it out and everyone had a game planned. And during the course of a 12-hour day, the five people in the cast would just work at these different stations that were set up on the stage. And some people would go to the makeup truck, some people would go to these stations. You would do it on the set. You'd go in the back after doing the master of one scene in a living room that's also going to play present day. You'd go in the back, throw on a different costume, come out on the same angle, do the present day stuff, light change, come back, put the mustache and stuff back on. But to work that way is great.
I'm glad I wasn't there. I would have had a heart attack.
It was great. Fred Ward is in that episode.
Yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun. And, we have wonderful guest stars this year. Treat Williams is a guest star for us this year. I mean, some really terrific actors. Matthew Lillard,
and Steve Valentine.
Yep.
Well, like we said, we're in season five. Doesn't that make Leverage one of the longest running shows on TNT right now?
With the closer leaving, we are the longest running show on TNT right now.
That's right.
Didn't you buy the plane for D.B. Cooper?
If anyone needs a plane set, we have one for rent up in Portland.
So, talking about season five, what do each of you do to keep the show feeling so fresh after five seasons? It never gets old. How do you each of you achieve that?
Well, if I may, for the actors, we read the script. No, because I mean, you read the script on this show. It's every script is so fresh. There's a license I think the writers have to take the characters and the story anywhere they want. I mean. Yeah, not just geographically, but I mean in terms of the relations, the interpersonal relationships in the show, they've evolved quite a bit. So it starts with reading a script. You read, you say, well, we've never done this before. And every script is like that. We've never done that. So it's always fresh in that way. And then when you start to apply what you're going to do with your own character toward this new idea, this new script, again, it's been set up in such a way that you have the license to kind of go way beyond the boundaries of what you've done before, and it makes it fun, and it keeps it fresh. You know, you're not doing this continuous storyline, so you do have the liberty to reach out a little bit.
I think that from the coming up with stories and script part, it's a endless deep pool of rage. it really is. Things enrage us. We read about things like Enron and we become furious, and there's nothing we can do about it except send our characters to go get revenge for us. So it's cathartic every week. And you know, if you pay any attention to what goes on in the world, there's plenty of things to enrage you. So as long as that happens, we'll be able to come up with episodes.
The rule in the writer's room is we don't do an episode about a villain until somebody actually, when we do the research about real people, goes, God, I hate that guy. And then you know that that's the guy that, you know, right, that you'll base things on. Not in a legal sense, but in a theoretical, non-suable, litigatable way.
Right.
They're fictional humans. But it was great. When we created the show, Dean very much gave us permission. And the nature of the show is a con and heist show. It's not a murder. You don't show up and there's a dead body and you banter over the dead body every week. It's a movie a week, and that's kind of the fun of it. And so every week we kind of go, where are we going this week? Yeah, let's go.
There was actually a report that came out recently about violence on television, and we were very pleased to find out that we were in the bottom percentage of violence, and yet we're an action show. So, I mean, I think it really shows that you don't have to be cutting people's throats and shooting people
We talked about when we were creating the show that there's an awful lot of people hunting serial killers on television, probably more serial killers than actually ever existed. Yeah.
The market on skinny white loners living in trailers, leaving poetry clues, that's kind of cornered. People have that now.
Baroque kind of clue paths.
I am
bodies.
The clockmaker.
Yeah. but you know, no one was going after Wall Street and the people that were bringing our economy to its knees, and so that's felt like a fertile field, and it's certainly been so for the five seasons of the show.
And that's key also, is that when I say the studio's one guy, the great thing is, as a result, there's not a lot of creative drift. I mean, we sit down all the time, and from the first day, we were like, are we all making the same show in our head? You know, do we all think this is the same show? And Chris and I were really trying to create at that time of sort of 1960s Rockford Files throwback, and Dean had that very much like team sensibility. I want that kind of action-adventure show that doesn't have to be gritty and people murdered and stuff, but just something you can watch. And it really, and Ellery Queen kind of came in, we talked about that, you know, your dad's show, and it was, we tried to make a show you could watch with your dad. And that's, you know, we hit it, so we're pretty happy.
We have some audience questions. Oh, if you want to do some audience, we can save them for the end, or we can do them now, whatever's...
Why don't you throw one in?
We'll throw one in. Okay, let's see here. So, John, I know how well you guys research your show. What was the story behind the Van Gogh painting true?
The painter on the road to Tarascon was an actual painting. It was lost in the bombing of Magdeburg in Germany in 1943. Everything else, the recovery of it, it's showing up in Portland, the historical romance at the core of it, all made up, but it's a real painting, and, you know, it's always better to be able to start with something, with a foundation of something that's real, and to build off from that. And once I looked for a lot of different lost masterpieces, and this one... Just spoke to me, and John did an amazing job of making the painting a character in the episode. As John said, Nadine Hayters, our costume designer, incorporated the colors and all the costumes, and you know one of my favorite lines in the episode at the end is that this was a guy who was going to work. And that's what the painting was about, and that this guy that had been spent his whole life chasing it just sort of lost that idea. And so, yeah, I mean, that was the truth behind it.
Well, grifters, we'll be taking a break from the Q&A panel here. Please tune in next time to catch the second half of the special edition of the Leverage 10 podcast. And don't forget to tune in to Leverage's Season 5 premiere this Sunday, July 15th at 8 p.m. only on TNT. Thanks for listening. Don't forget, grifters, you can download the new Season 5 episodes from iTunes after they air, as well as all your old favorites. And be sure to check out the new Leverage Series Companion ebook, available for download on the iTunes Store.